Wretched Radio begins in 3, 2, 1.
Word association with John MacArthur.
I use the complete idiot's guide to the Bible.
Unqualified.
Why can't my kids come into the service? Because we have PG-13 services.
Unqualified.
That has a nice ring to it. Unqualified.
It wasn't a compliment.
Junior church has taken over. It's designed for elementary kids or junior higher.
Who doesn't feel unqualified?
It's time for Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Thank you. Thank you, Time Magazine. This is Wretched Radio. Time Magazine, where have they been for the last 2,000 years? To help us understand this headline, what Jesus really said about heaven and hell. Whew, now we're finally going to get to know the truth. Who do they bring in to pinch hit on this not controversial subject? The one, the only, Bart Ehrman. That's right. This is a fellow. He's got his PhD in theology. He really does. And he no longer believes in God. And so he continues to make a living on God by warring against him and writing a screed in Time Magazine to bring some clarity to, frankly, what isn't confusing. Question: what is the best defense of the doctrine of hell? Would you say that it's the gospel? Would you say that it is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ that is the strongest defense for the doctrine of hell? A book that I just finished reading called Is There Anything Good About Hell? By one Paul Dirks. I believe he's a Canadian. He writes this: the substitutionary nature of Christ's death upon the cross is at once the most powerful defense of hell and its greatest escape. It is the greatest defense of hell, for surely if there is not an eternal hell of the greatest possible torments, God would not have sent his Son to endure such agony. Without hell, there would be no need for the cross. Given the historical fact of Christ's crucifixion, God would be a moral monster if there were not an eternal hell to demand such penal suffering. If there is no hell, either Jesus is not God's Son, or God is not good. The man who feels he has progressed beyond the barbaric notion of retributive justice and wants to free God from the shackles of hell actually makes God out to be far more evil in the process. The cross, with all of its torments and tortures, sufferings and sorrows, was absolutely necessary for God to save us from the hellfire our sins demanded. The number one defense, according to this author, of hell is the cross. Why else would God do that to his Son? If hell were, say, limited in its torments or timeline, we wouldn't see what we saw 2,000 years ago, the most brutal, violent death ever, being whipped, punched, beaten, spat upon, and then nailed to a tree in public. The worst death imaginable. It points us toward the reality of hell being the worst place imaginable. Perhaps you've uttered a sentiment that many theologians have. I suspect it's because they were trying to make one point without undermining the doctrine of hell. But so often we'll hear people say, you know, if I could get rid of one thing in the Bible, it would be hell. Oh, no, no, no. Don't do that. Because if you desire to get rid of hell, you are going to diminish the gospel. You are going to minimize the cross. Let's take a little gander and see what Dr. Ehrman had to say about hell and what it really is. Quote, neither Jesus nor the Hebrew Bible he interpreted endorsed the view that departed souls go to paradise or everlasting pain. That's just inaccurate. Let me share with you a little history on the doctrine of hell, remembering that the Bible is indeed a progressive revelation, that the Bible makes some things that begin fuzzy much more clear as time progresses, and so it is with hell. Sheol, you've heard that term used before. It's the place of the dead where eternal souls dwell in a sleepy, shade-like existence, receiving to some degree the fruits of their deeds. That would be Isaiah 14. That's describing Sheol. The Bible isn't clear. And at least some of these passages, Sheol means to be a neutral locality and is described as a dwelling place of both the righteous and the wicked. And then there's a slew of verses. At other times, the saints express hope in eternal life and glory. David finished Psalm 23 by saying, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord." How long? Forever. Again, fuzzy. It gets progressively clear. Psalm 73, the author states confidently, "You guide me with your counsel, and afterwards you will receive me to glory." I think we're up to three so far. Psalm 16:10, a clear prophecy of Christ according to the apostles, citing that verse, "For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy, and at your right hands there are pleasures forevermore." This is just nonsense. A simple fact. If we just had Facebook making sure that we got the true story, this Time article would have never appeared. Isn't it funny? If it's inaccurate Christian slander, we'll allow that. But if it's Christians saying anything we don't like, we're going to censor. I mean, we're going to control the narrative so that people aren't deceived. Neither Jesus nor the Hebrew Bible endorse the view that departed souls go to paradise or everlasting pain. Oh, really? Job says, "For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another." I think that's four verses now. Jimmy, I don't know how good your math skills are. Might want to break out the abacus. We're up to four so far.
Okay, I'm keeping up.
Last chapter of Isaiah, the Lord arrives in a fury of fire to judge all flesh. Those who offer the impure flesh of animals to the Lord will die and be an eternal abhorrence to all flesh. That'd be five. Daniel and his vision of the resurrection. This one is a verse that everybody at least remember the address. It's not hard. You know Romans 12, 1 and 2, right? Do not be conformed to the pattern of this world. Think Daniel 12, 1 through 3. Verses 2 and 3 make it clear. They anticipated a resurrection. "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." Let me just see. Maybe they didn't mean to actually say that the Bible does not endorse the view that departed souls go to paradise or everlasting pain. Huh. It seems that the Old Testament does. Repeatedly. The Time magazine article states, "Most people today would be surprised to learn that Jesus did not believe in hell as a place of eternal torment." Except for the fact that he talked about the place where the worm never dies. "And some will go to everlasting life and to everlasting contempt." You know that word everlasting? I think what it means is everlasting. Pretty certain about that. I'm not a formidable Greek scholar, but I'm pretty sure everlasting means forever. The Bible does not start talking about hell at the arrival of Jesus Christ. Instead, it began in the Old Testament. Sheol represented for the Hebrews the ultimate and lasting abode of those who were excluded from the divine presence. There's another OT word we should know about: Gehenna. Second Old Testament theme is woven into Jesus' teachings on hell by his frequent use of Gehenna. It's a transliteration of the Hebrew Valley of Hinnom. This valley lies outside of Jerusalem, and it was a place of abomination. The Canaanites, the evil kings Ahaz and Manasseh, perform ritual child sacrifice there in the fires of the demon god Molech. So what was that place known as? And a place of abomination. for the most abominable sins, where fathers offered their own flesh in fire to demons. Hinnon was a place of defilement. 2 Kings 23 gives a detailed account of the various idols, high places, and altars that Josiah destroyed. Quote, Topheth, which is the valley of the son of Hinnon, that no one might burn his son or daughter as an offering. The very public defilement meant the valley would be recognized forever as a place of contempt. You might run into somebody who goes, well, you know, the Bible doesn't use the word hell in the Old Testament. Right. But it does use the word Sheol, as we've studied, and the word Gehenna, which meant to them a place of everlasting contempt. So when Jesus uses the term, that's what he means too. But alas, Jesus didn't stop there. He didn't just make allusions to the Old Testament. Nope, he progressed in the revelation of the doctrine of hell to give a ton of descriptors. Did Jesus endorse the doctrine of everlasting life and everlasting hell? That's just a nonsensical question. But here's my question for Vu. Without using a verse on Sheol, Gehenna, or hell, can you support the doctrine of hell from the Bible? Next on Wretched Radio. And now a message from our dear brother Paul Marty of the Tomorrow Club's Kids Bible Clubs all throughout Eastern Europe. Just in case it isn't difficult enough to do ministry in poor Eastern Europe.
2020 has been a challenging year for all of us, and especially hard for the vulnerable kids and families that Tomorrow Club serve. But support from the Wretched audience has enabled us to continue to bring a message of hope, the gospel of Jesus Christ, to the forsaken places we serve. Thank you so much.
If you are a Tomorrow Club supporter, I echo his gratitude. If you are not, would you please consider becoming a Tomorrow Club supporter? You can sponsor your own kids' club in Eastern Europe so efficiently. Just $30 per month to disciple 30 kids. Learn more at tomorrowclubs.org/wretched. tomorrowclubs.org/wretched.
2021 has been the best yet at Wretched, and I'm not sure I have enough time to even cover it all, but let's try. This year we rolled out a new curriculum of Wretched Bible Studies. Drive-By Biblical Counseling 3 was released. Wretched Worldview hit the streets. Tom Hammond's newest booklet, Solving the God Puzzle, became available, and Season 2 of Road Trip to Truth was released. And that's just our big resource releases this year. We can't forget about our big move over the summer or the fact that as of today, Wretched Radio can be heard on over 800 radio stations worldwide. Wretched TV can be found on over 135 Christian networks, our YouTube channel, almost 4 million hours watched this year alone, and none of this would be possible without our gospel partners. During this year-end season, would you please prayerfully consider becoming a gospel partner? 2022 promises to be our best yet with our new documentary series, Transformed, set to be released, highlighting the life-changing power of biblical counseling. So visit wretched.org/donate or text the word wretched to the number 44321 to become a gospel partner today.
And yet one more reason to consider MediShare, affordable biblical health sharing, 400,000 Christians strong and growing, sharing one another's medical expenses so far to the tune of $4 billion. The average family saves $500 per month. That's a good reason to consider MediShare. There's a teledoc service. That's a good reason to consider MediShare. How's about their approval ratings are double that of traditional health insurance? But how's about this? During the month of November, initiation fee waived. One more reason for you to discover if MediShare is right for you and for your family. Simply visit MediShare.com/wretched and take 2 minutes to call 1-844-34-BIBLE. To see how much your family can save. 1-844-34-BIBLE for MediShare.
Know your reformers. John Wycliffe, called the Morning Star of the Reformation, was a professor at Oxford in the 1300s who preached against papal authority in matters of doctrine, politics, and church practice. After his death, his bones were dug up, burned, and spread over the river. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Can you prove the doctrine of hell without quoting Jesus Christ? This is Wretched Radio, Time Magazine. Finally telling us what Jesus really meant. Claiming Jesus never talked about eternal damnation and eternal life. Ay, ay, ay. You could cite the parable of the 10 virgins, the parable of the lost sheep. What did Jesus say? These will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. You can quote pretty much Matthew 24, 25, a repeated lengthy treatise on the doctrine and eternality of hell. And yet, Time Magazine has the chutzpah to tell us, we're going to tell you what Jesus really said. We don't need a fancy schmancy menangled interpretation. What he said is clear, but here is my challenge for you. Can you prove the doctrine of hell without quoting Jesus Christ? A book entitled Is There Anything Good About Hell by Paul Dirks does a lengthy treatise on the doctrine, spending a great deal of time all over the Bible, presenting an airtight case that there is much about hell that is actually, brace yourself, good. And if we lose the doctrine of hell, we lose the cross, we lose the gospel, we lose a lot about the goodness of God, we lose his love in its fullness. And it also goes about the business of extrapolating from the Bible. If you just consider what this clearly states, what is the implication on the doctrine of hell? And he does it magnificently. And one of his demonstrations is a story. The ancient historian Herodotus tells of an horrific. I love it when people use the an in front of an H. Thank you, sir. Herodotus tells of a horrific punishment imposed by the Persian king Cambyses, upon his royal judge Sizamnes, who had taken a bribe. Okay, so here's the, just so we can remember this, King C went after Prophet S because he took a bribe, not Prophet, but Judge S, who had taken a bribe. The king punished Judge S by cutting his throat and flaying his skin. Whew. I'm gonna be watching the Food Channel a little differently from now on. The skin was then draped over the judgment seat as a testimony to the next judge who was to preside there. None other than Judge S's own son, Judge O. Herodotus notes that the king admonished the new younger judge, quote, to keep in mind the nature of the throne on which he was sitting. Chilling, but perhaps ancient wisdom at work. The story continues, despite all the horror of Judge S's death and flaying, it may have been for the sake of his subjects that the king acted. Although it was likely an object of horror to Judge O, consider what the throne would have communicated to a poor plaintiff. So the poor guy gets called into court, and there's a judge. His life is in one man's hand. You know, we changed a lot of that. That's why we have juries. That's why we try to have a system of blind justice and one of the peers, as opposed to somebody who is lofty and above, rendering all verdicts. And we see that developing, but at this time, this judge held your life in his hands. Although it was an object of horror, it communicated to a poor plaintiff, because there's nothing more terrifying to an innocent man than an unjust judge on the judgment seat. Their covering of skin served not only as a reminder of the importance of justice to the judge, but also as a beacon of hope to the oppressed. A man could trust the justice of a judge who sat on such a throne. Are you starting to see how we can make a case for the doctrine of hell? By studying God's character and nature and his desire to uphold justice? the story continues, what kind of judge would we want to meet on the day of judgment? A judgess whose tainted character meant injustice to many? Why? Because he would take a bribe? That guy wasn't fair. What about Judge O, whose decisions are just, but because of external coercion. Or King C, a judge whose internal integrity compelled him to insist on justice in his realm at any cost. You'd want King C. You want a man who isn't bribed. You want a man who is fair. You want a man who isn't capricious. Now, obviously, the story limps because God doesn't kill and flay people. But it does point us towards some reasoning on the doctrine of hell. That this doctrine reminds us, whoa, God is serious about justice way more than we are. And that is exactly the type of judge we want. You don't want reprobates being set free or tiptoeing through the tulips of hell. You want penal justice, don't you? And God does too, but about a gazillion times more, because he wants justice for every sin that has ever been committed. Let me take you in this book titled, Is There Anything Good About Hell?, to perhaps a surprising area of scripture that proves that hell is right and that hell is just. Jonathan Edwards writes, he is a being of infinite greatness, majesty, and glory, and therefore is infinitely honorable. He is infinitely exalted above the greatest potentates of the earth, the highest angels in heaven, and therefore he is infinitely more honorable than they. His authority over us is infinite, and the ground of his right to our obedience is infinitely strong, for he is infinitely worthy to be obeyed. And we have an absolute, universal, and infinite dependence upon him. So that sin against God, being a violation of infinite obligations, must be a crime infinitely heinous and so deserving of infinite punishment. Nothing is more agreeable to the common sense of man than these sins committed against anyone must be proportionably heinous to the dignity of the being offended and abused. Here I thought I was being brilliant. Years ago, I'm pretty sure I concocted this scenario. If I tell a lie to my son, nothing happens. He doesn't have any power. I lie to my wife. I sleep on the couch. I lie to my boss. I get fired. I lie to a judge. I go to jail. Same crime, different punishment. Why? The honor, the power, the authority of the judge increased. That's why when we sin, it is worthy of infinite punishment because we sin against an infinite holy one. Here I thought, Edwards was onto that concept. And so was Anselm. He was onto this also. He used, I think, like a beggar and a pauper, something like that. You know, that if one beggar kills another beggar, it's no big deal. But if a beggar lays his hands on a prince, big deal. So the idea is nothing new. But then what this book, Is There Anything Good About Hell, points toward is parents. You say parents. I'm not making the connection. Well, let's let this book do it for us as we try to make the case for hell without quoting Jesus. Oh, I got to put my glasses on. I thought I could do it without it. Okay, here it is. Every authority-blessing relationship in human society is a reflection of the authority-blessing relationship the Creator has with his creatures. We then understand something of these ultimate truths by careful consideration of the lesser shadows. For instance, the relationship of children to their parents. Are we to give greater honor to our parents than to others? If the answer is yes, why? And related to this question, does this greater obligation result in greater punishment when it is not met? Parents point toward the necessity of hell. Why? Because when a child commits a crime, a sin, is disobedient to a parent, that's worse than to a stranger. And who is most infinitely connected to us? It's not our parents. It's God. Even the pagan, whose life and breath is in the hands of God. Our relationship as human beings with God is totally and utterly dependent on Him, as Jonathan Edwards said, which means if children get punished more severely for committing a crime against their parents, how much more so should we receive for committing a crime against our Heavenly Father, whether we acknowledge Him as such or not? Every society agrees. You honor your parents. You do what you're told. It's your parents. Why? Because they've given so much. They've done so much. They provided so much. And God has done all of that and a million things more, which means when we sin against Him, it demands the most severe punishment imaginable. That alone proves that the doctrine of hell does not need to be reinterpreted by Dr. Bart Ehrman in Time magazine. No, we conclude what we've understood for 2,000 years. It's what Jesus taught, that hell is eternal, conscious torment. And you don't just have to take His word for it. This is Wretched Radio.
This is Wretched Radio, and I'm Jimmy Hicks. Well, we start today in Loudoun County, Virginia, with the Loudoun County School Board, or the Lousy County School Board. I think that's their preferred pronoun. They suspended PE teacher Tanner Cross earlier this year for speaking up against a policy that required staff to use the name and pronoun a student prefers. So we need to use their preferred pronoun, Lousy County School Board. Anyway, in an update, the district has agreed to a settlement in a case that has seen Cross win multiple rounds in court, including the Virginia Supreme Court. And as a part of that settlement, the district has agreed to remove any reference to the prior suspension from Cross's file. They've also agreed to reinstate Cross and pay $20,000 towards his attorney fees. The Alliance Defending Freedom called it a victory for Cross and free speech, commenting, quote, "Teachers shouldn't be forced to promote ideologies that are harmful to students and that they believe are false, and they certainly should not be silenced from commenting publicly." You learn something new every day, right? Who knew the characters on Sesame Street had races? I certainly didn't. With characters that are orange, green, purple, red, blue, and other colors, race is the last thing I think the original Sesame Street creators were worried about. But now the show apparently is worried about race, because there was an announcement made yesterday that the show has a new Asian American puppet. Why, you ask? Well, I'm asking the same question myself, because according to the show's website, the show was founded in 1969 to help educate children. And today, according to their website, two major areas of focus for the show are racial justice and gender equity. So the emphasis today is not on educating kids, it's on indoctrinating them with your personal ideologies. And if you haven't thought this country is going after our children in order to brainwash them, you don't have to look much further than this or the previous story about what's happened with the Lousy County School Board in Virginia. And another mecca for ideology, California, and their supreme ruler Gavin Newsom have been tirelessly working to make the state the abortion hub of the U.S. According to reports, Newsom recently asked a group of health people, that's what I'll call them, to devise plans to make abortion easier for women from other states to come to California to murder their unborn babies. What a leader! No, what a human! Newsom is concerned that the U.S. Supreme Court could limit or overturn Roe v. Wade next month. That would mean roughly 26 U.S. states could quickly ban abortions soon after. So Newsom wants to take advantage of that and attract all the baby murderers to his haven of baby murder in California. Again, what a human. He's such a great guy. More Wretched Radio is straight ahead. I'm Jimmy Hicks.
Important dates in Christian history. 1735. The Great Awakening under Jonathan Edwards stirs the American colonies with many conversions and individual returns to heartfelt faith. Because of this awakening, a number of divinity schools were founded, including Princeton, Dartmouth, and Rutgers. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
We interrupt our regularly scheduled promotion of Road Trip to Truth Season 2 because I got this in my email. This is Wretched Radio. Can't wait to share with you little inside scoop on one Charles Darwin and what his attitude was toward people with different skin colors, which we should all know about in our cancel culture as we go about the business of canceling anybody who appears in the slightest to be racist. Charles Darwin was a thoroughgoing racist. We'll get to that as a part of our regularly scheduled plug. But I just received this in the email, and if you are one of the folks that said, you know, maybe chanting "Let's go, Brandon" isn't such a bad thing. It's okay to do it because this guy is really terrible, and I've also heard he's not really the president. Therefore, chanting "Let's go, Brandon" is okay. I want you to imagine this scene. You're about to hear a church. It's packed. It's one of those with a balcony. It appears to have thousands of people sitting in this, well, prosperity church. But that doesn't matter. The world doesn't understand that. They don't discern whether it's prosperity or orthodox, small o. They just hear this and go, wow, how's about those Christians? And how's about their Christ? What would you think if you were an atheist and you heard or saw this video that I'm about to play on my cell phone into the microphone? A spontaneous "Let's go, Brandon" chant during church. Do you think somebody might get saved from that? Do you think that somebody might have an higher opinion of Christians or Jesus Christ when they see that? Maybe, just maybe, that will give you pause to consider whether or not we should be participating in this current fad. And now we return to our regularly scheduled plug of Road Trip to Truth Season 2.
Was Charles Darwin a racist?
Charles Darwin was definitely a racist. He wasn't the world's first, and he wasn't the only one, and there were a lot of other people who were racist, but Charles Darwin was definitely a racist.
So is there any passage or section of his writing that would like really prove his racism?
I think his book, The Descent of Man, does a pretty good job.
Yeah.
He talks there about how different races have different mental capabilities, how the gap between the highest ape and the lowest human being. And he places that gap with basically blacks from Africa and Australian Aborigines. That's pretty racist to me.
Yeah.
The lowest humans on the evolutionary scale, right above the gorillas, are blacks.
Do you think that racism is contrary to the theory of evolution, or do you think racism actually aligns with the theory of evolution?
Racism is actually built in to the theory of evolution as Darwin conceived it. Now, again, in Darwin's view, we aren't human beings because God or a beneficent designer designed us in different people groups to have the same capacities. We're the way we are because of this process of natural selection that acts differently on different people groups based on the survival needs each of those groups have. So in a Darwinian view, you should expect races to have significant differences.
Do you think that that means the theory of evolution is automatically wrong?
Of course not. I think evolution needs to rise or fall on the merits of the evidence for it. But again, if it's saying some things that we know for other reasons probably is not true, you should at least begin to question, why do we believe it?
Should.
If you knew that someone used a philosophy or idea to treat certain people in a less than humane way, do you think that idea might be bad?
Yeah.
I would say so, yeah.
Yes.
You've claimed before that Theodore Roosevelt was influenced by Charles Darwin. How is that?
Well, Teddy Roosevelt was a big supporter of evolution. He even wrote a long essay for National Geographic where he talks about the age of man, where he actually goes through human evolution and calls Darwin's book, The Descent of Man, a masterpiece. So he unquestionably was influenced by evolution. So were other people like Woodrow Wilson, who was a great proponent of Darwin's theory. And actually, Woodrow Wilson used Darwin's theory as a justification for the evolving constitution and the idea that government should change and get bigger and bigger because everything evolves. Darwin taught us that. In fact, Woodrow Wilson said that in a campaign speech.
So what do you think of the idea of sterilizing certain people so they can't have kids because they might not be as advanced as everyone else?
I think that's kind of messed up.
Kind of.
Why?
Because I think, like, if you want kids, you should have kids. Like, if someone told me that I couldn't have a kid because, like, if I have, like, some disorder or something, like, I'd be really upset about that.
I mean, I don't think that's correct.
That's awful.
You've also talked about Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. How was he Darwinian?
Oliver Wendell Holmes thought that at the base, Darwin was right, that it's a struggle for survival of the fittest. And so basically that those groups that were strongest, they should get their way. And this played into some of his Supreme Court rulings, based actually civil rights rulings, where he basically rubber stamped white supremacists doing what they did because they were the majority. They were the strongest in the South. And then when it gets to something called forced sterilization in eugenics, which he thought was constitutional, again, very closely tracked to Darwin's view.
Do you think that certain people are better than others simply because they're smarter, or does everyone have the same value?
I think that everyone has the same value.
Do you think that certain people are better than others simply because they're smarter?
No.
Well, I don't think inherently people are just better because they are those things.
So do you really think it's fair to kind of pin those bad ideas on Darwin?
I think we have to distinguish between Darwin as a man, who was a kindly man, and I think he was better than his theory, and the actual principles of his theory. I think it's fair to ask, given the principles of his theory, what should you believe? And when it comes to particularly race, it's pretty clear that Darwin's theory set an agenda for scientific racism by saying that we should expect significant differences between the races. Some Darwinists are honest enough to admit this. Stephen Jay Gould, very noted paleontologist at Harvard, who was a big-time Darwinist, basically said that after Darwin's theory was adopted, scientific racism basically grew by leaps and bounds.
Do you think there were any other notable 20th century people who used Darwin's evolutionary theory to justify their racist attitude?
Who didn't? I mean, it was just used by everyone. So by politicians and by scientists. There was a United States senator from South Carolina, Ben Tillman, Democratic senator for a couple of decades, who was just a raving racist. And he actually made a point of comparing, at least some blacks were so close to the monkey that scientists are still looking for the missing link. He definitely was influenced by Darwin. Charles Davenport was one of the co-founders of the whole field of genetics and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He also thought, like Darwin, that different races should have different capacities based on natural selection. Now let me give you one more, a little more recent, but one of the most prominent scientists from the 20th century, who's actually still in the 21st century, James Watson, co-discoverer with Francis Crick of the structure of DNA, won the Nobel Prize, got in trouble just a few years ago because he's propounding the view, that goes back to Darwin, that he thinks that African blacks are inferior to European whites. Why? Because of evolution. Because evolution acts differently on different populations based on their survival needs.
Oodles of big intellects believe Charles Darwin was onto something with that survival of the fittest business, that there are obviously some ethnic groups that are more advanced than others. What a shocker, he concluded. It was his own group that was the most advanced, and yet Charles Darwin has had not only an impact on some scholars, some judges, but on some philosophers who have had a big nasty impact on the 20th century.
Socialism, the idea of distribution of wealth, the idea that not just an equality of opportunity, but also an equality of outcome. Do you think that socialism is a good idea?
To a degree, yes and no.
Maybe for some. I think that, like, a little bit of socialism's okay, but, like, not, like, crazy.
You ever heard of Karl Marx?
Yeah. He was kind of the guy who influenced a lot of the 20th century socialism, and he was a massive racist. Yeah.
I did not know that.
So do you think that changes your view at all about, like, the idea of socialism?
To a certain extent, yeah. Okay.
Probably not.
I feel like this is a trick question.
Mm-hmm.
Was Karl Marx a fan of Darwin?
He was.
How big of a fan are we talking about?
Big enough that Karl Marx inscribed a personal copy of his very thick book, Das Kapital, and sent it to Darwin.
Having
said that, Karl Marx was a snooty German intellectuals, and they liked to thumb their noses at Englishmen. So although he did think highly of Darwin, he did derisively sort of say that he wrote in his crude English style.
Mm. How did Marx use Darwin's theory of evolution?
Well, he took two main points from it. One was the death of teleology and purpose.
It's just what the point of the whole planet is. Why are we here?
Darwin provides the linchpin for believing that we're the product of an unguided material process. The second one was Darwin, by talking about the struggle for survival of the fittest, Marx actually thought that provided a basis in natural history for his idea of the class struggle. It's important to say Marx didn't like the idea of survival of the fittest. Marx thought that Darwin correctly diagnosed the way we were, and then Marx was going to fix it by ushering in the new communist utopia. Marx's goal was not just to understand the world, but was to change it.
So do you think that today, people who claim to be socialist and communist, do you think they still adhere to Darwin's theory of evolution?
Well, certainly orthodox Marxists and communists do, because it's overwhelmingly materialistic and denies a belief in God, and matter runs everything, and that's their view of the universe, and Darwin is the linchpin for that worldview.
Well, well, well. Charles Darwin has a connection to Karl Marx. Isn't that kooky? No, it's not. Why? Because worldviews and ideas have consequences. And the worldview and idea, that's all it is, known as Darwinian evolution, has had massive consequences on all of us. Get your copy of Road Trip to Truth Season 2 at wretched.org. This is Wretched Radio.
You know, just a quick perusal of the Wretched store and wretched.org, and you'll notice resources like Road Trip to Truth, Life is Best, Untethered, Wretched Worldview, and all of our resources have one very distinct thing in common. And no, it's not Todd's ugly mug. Okay, maybe two things in common, but what I'm referring to, or who I'm referring to, is you. Seriously, because if you're a gospel partner, you are actually responsible for the resources we produce. We're just the mouthpiece, but our gospel partners are the engines that make Wretched run. Without you, there is no us. So if you're already a gospel partner, we humbly thank you. And if you're not an ongoing monthly gospel partner, would you please prayerfully consider becoming one and help us continue producing biblically sound, Christ-centered content to reach the lost and edify the saints? Visit wretched.org/donate to get all the details on becoming a Wretched Gospel Partner today. That's wretched.org/donate. It truly does take us all.
You are a pro-life Christian, which is redundant, who happens to be frugal, which is unnecessary to point out because that's what we Christians are, frugal, and you would like to support a life ministry that stewards your money well. Some great news from Preborn Ministries. They have saved 169,000 babies' lives. What is their secret? Ultrasounds. 80% of the time a woman sees her baby, she chooses life. Right now, Preborn has a matching grant. $28 per ultrasound turns into two ultrasounds. Or for $140, you can sponsor five ultrasounds, but because of the match, you'll be saving 10 babies. The ideal time for you to support a life ministry who's going to steward your money well. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, #250, keyword baby, or visit preborn.org/wretched.
I know you didn't think we could do it, but hey, we did, and we've over-delivered on Road Trip to Truth Season 2. It's here now, and it's on sale at roadtriptotruth.org or wretched.org/roadtrip. Don't miss out on all new topics and new experts with, of course, the same great host, John Fabares. Road Trip to Truth Season 2 and all of our resources are made possible by the support of our gospel partners. If you're a gospel partner already, we want to say thank you. Your generous gifts have made it possible for Wretched, Road Trip to Truth, Wretched Worldview, our drive-by series, or our new upcoming television series, Transform, to be created and reach millions of people all over the world. Thank you so much to our gospel partners. If you're not already a gospel partner, would you prayerfully consider becoming one? Just visit wretched.org/donate to find out how you can support our goal in reaching the world with the gospel. Wretched. Amazing grace. Amazing gospel.
Books of the Bible. Lamentations is a book of poems written by Jeremiah after the fall of Jerusalem. They are marked by weeping, woes, and affliction. But even in sorrow, Jeremiah praises God. He proclaims God's justice, cries out to God for mercy, and confesses his faith in God. Lamentations teaches us a godly way to express sorrow and grow in the midst of loss. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Nazi Germany, obviously Hitler was in charge, and he exterminated 6 million Jews. Do you know why he did that?
I don't know. I don't know too much about it.
Okay. Do you know why he did that?
No, can you tell me?
Well, he just...
Dibbity-doo, this is Wretched Radio. That was the voice of John Fabares interviewing students on university campuses to test their knowledge of a figure everybody knows about. We all done know what he did. He exterminated millions of Jewish people. Where did Adolf Hitler get his ideas?
Do you know any of the books that influenced Hitler to think that way about the Jewish people?
I do not.
If you found out that he used a book to scientifically prove that the Jews should be obliterated, do you think we should trust that book?
Honestly, it just depends on what the book
really?
Is.
No, not at all. If the teachings are teaching hate, then no.
Oh. If one book taught hate, it sure would be Mein Kampf. This is from Road Trip to Truth, Season 2. John Fabares, ooh, just had a baby. He didn't. His wife did. You get what I'm trying to say? I'm not Paul Anka here. He just had a baby. Congratulations to John and to Alexandra. Everybody's healthy. Everybody is good. I just am thrilled for that. I sent John a text, and I said something that via text requires some sort of an emoji or an explanation. I said, congratulations, praise God. Now life really begins. And if you didn't know my tone, it could be condescending. Well, you've just been floundering around. Now life begins. That's not what I meant at all. Life can be fulfilling. Life can have purpose prior to having children, but life really begins when you start providing for somebody who is totally relying on you. And you forge a bond with that child that is unlike any other bond you will ever have. So congratulations to John and Alexandra. Everybody's healthy. Everybody's happy. He is the host of Road Trip to Truth, Season 2. It featured Dr. John G. West from the Discovery Institute giving us the 911 on Charles Darwin.
You claim Adolf Hitler was also influenced by Charles Darwin.
You cannot read Hitler's writings without getting racial struggle and the whole idea of the will of the stronger and the battle of life. He gets that from Darwin and Darwinian type thinkers.
So did any other Nazis cite Charles Darwin as a source of authority?
It was replete throughout Nazism. The biology curriculum that was actually adopted by the Nazi Ministry of Education was replete with Darwinism. Oh. Nazi universities, Nazi magazines, Nazi official newspapers, and Nazi propaganda films. In fact, if you go back and watch how they taught about killing off what they thought were the defective and people who were dragged on societies, they actually created films that went out into theaters that showed killing in nature, how nature kills off damaged rabbits, damaged birds, and said that we in human society are sinning against what? The Bible? No. Against the law of natural selection by trying to keep people that they regard as defective alive.
Nice.
Can we really blame Darwin for the extermination of millions of Jewish people?
The really issue is not about Darwin as a person. It's about Darwin's ideas. And if you really believe, as Darwin set out, that the only thing that created us is not a benevolent creator who planned us, but this ruthless process of survival of the fittest that weeded out the unfit. Really, mass death is our creator. If that's what you believe, and then you find out, well, that because of our humanitarian ideals fed by the Judeo-Christian tradition, that we are actually surmounting the law of the jungle by trying to save the people that Darwin's process would kill off, then what are you left with? You're left with a world of hurt. Now, Darwin was squeamish. Darwin didn't, want to go the full distance because of that.
Does Darwinian evolution really support Hitler's views?
If you think mass death is our creator, and that it weeded out all these people who are biologically unfit, and that's the only reason we have the capabilities we have. If your society stops doing that so it can be kind and compassionate, then you have a problem.
Mm-hmm. You certainly do. A problem we've seen repeated over and over again. Jimmy, I just realized This was a big mistake to play the second segment of Road Trip to Truth Season 2 on Charles Darwin.
Why?
Well, we mentioned the name Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
Remember the last time we did that and posted it on Facebook? That would be last January.
Okay.
They shut us down.
Ah.
Yes, they blocked us so that nobody...
Because we said he was bad?
No. Oh. I made the mistake while preaching the gospel of suggesting that if Adolf Hitler had repented, put his trust in Jesus Christ, the gospel of grace is so big, even the sins of Adolf Hitler could be forgiven.
Ah.
We got blocked on Facebook. Apparently, we're no longer going to be in the timeout chair next January. So they put us on a hold for 1 year.
Really?
Oh, I just love censorship. Just love it. We should have asked John West if censorship is somehow related to Charles Darwin, because Charles Darwin sure did end up having a lot of his evolutionary fingers in a lot of 20th century pots.
Who was Margaret Sanger, and was she racist?
Margaret Sanger was the founder of what became known as Planned Parenthood. And yes, she was definitely a racist. She gave regular talks to the Ku Klux Klan, and she spent a lot of time trying to reduce the reproduction of those that she thought were less desirable. And a lot of those just happened to be blacks, Hispanics, immigrants. And now she would say that she was doing that to help them, and maybe she believed that, maybe she didn't. But she would also call those people by names like weeds, parasites, the dead weight of human waste. Those are direct quotes.
Oh.
And so I think she pretty much was racist.
What was her relationship with Charles Darwin?
She obviously was informed by Darwin's views. And in fact, there was one writing where she compares Australian Aborigines as basically the lowest humans on the evolutionary ladder that have brains just above the chimpanzee. Certainly her ideas on eugenics and weeding out the unfit also owed a lot to Darwin's beliefs on natural selection.
Were there any particular people groups that Sanger targeted?
Blacks, Hispanics, immigrants, basically those who weren't of the white Anglo-Saxon Nordic variety.
So you talked about Sanger's relationship with abortion and Planned Parenthood. Can you really prove that Sanger used Darwin's theories of evolution to perpetuate abortions?
Margaret Sanger, for all of her bad things, actually thought abortion was wrong. And so she didn't promote abortion. Now, there were many people who did and who drew on Darwin's theory to do it. Chief among them was a guy named Ernst Haeckel, who's a German scientist who actually thought that we replay the history of evolution in the womb. And so that means that if you are going through the fish stage, then that's okay to abort because you're not really a human being. And up into, actually even today, in the 1980s, you had a member of the National Academy of Sciences testify before Congress making this argument. You had later than that, in the 1990s, Carl Sagan, the famous physicist. And in the 2000s, you had atheist Christopher Hitchens make that same argument. And so this trope, this idea that we go through the history of evolution in the womb, which is junk science, right, was one of the big arguments for why abortion was okay. Margaret Sanger herself was not one of the people who made it. But Planned Parenthood, after she died especially, then did take that up and become a big proponent of abortion.
You know what that means, don't you? When the world found out about this, they canceled Planned Parenthood. Actually, they didn't.
If I told you that there were institutions in America that were used as recently as 1970 to sterilize human beings against their will, would you believe that?
Yeah, I've heard worse. So yeah.
No, I probably wouldn't.
I would believe that. We actually just learned about that in my history class as well.
Can you think of any justification for forcibly sterilizing another human being?
I can't.
Not against their own will.
Can you think of any moral justification for doing something like that?
What is eugenics, and how have we seen eugenics in America?
The idea that we need to breed a better race and get rid of biological defectives through really Darwinian selection, or harnessing the power of Darwinian selection. Darwin thought and wrote about in The Descent of Man, by inoculating people against smallpox, saving the sick, helping the poor, doing all these things, we were actually helping to live the people that nature would have killed off. But that's our creator. Our creator is mass death, in Darwin's view. Mass death brought us who we are, brought us our capability by weeding out the unfit. So if you're someone living in today's humanitarian society, we're going to destroy the human race. So the eugenists said, well, we want to be kind and gentle, like Darwin. We don't want to go back to the law of the jungle, just kill people off. Let's try to do it scientifically by artificially selecting people, some who can have babies and others who can't. And so you had massive campaigns for things like forced sterilization, so that some people who are regarded as lower on the evolutionary scale, shall we say, couldn't have babies.
So how many people were institutionalized or sterilized in the 20th century in America?
Around 60,000 American women who were sterilized against their will.
Yikes. The influence of one Charles Darwin. Did you know that about Mr. Evolution? Do your kids know about it? Imagine them seeing this and being armed with this knowledge when they go to any sort of public institution. It might be helpful. That is why I would encourage you to consider getting yourself a copy of Road Trip to Truth, Season 2. Don't forget about the study guide. This is just one of 13 outstanding episodes available at wretched.org. And until tomorrow, go serve your king.